Well, my brother Charlie gave me the ticket and I went to Chicago. He had forgotten how skinny I was. I got one or two odd jobs around Chicago that summer. He didn't push me. He just went right along and said, just want to see whether you like it. You think you like it well enough to come up here and wake your butt off? Yeah, I think so. He said, well, I'll help you so long as you help yourself. But the day you stop waking yourself, I'm going to put your butt out. You understand? Oh, yeah, I understand. Okay. At the end of that year, I went back to Alcorn with my mind made up. At that time, the Alcorn College Band was tops. And I considered myself a pretty good trombone player. I played first trombone in the band, and I felt that I was equal to, if not better than, any trombone player in any college band. However, the time was not long coming before I'd find out that I wasn't quite so hot, period. The first trumpet player in our band was named DeWitt Buckingham, DeWitt Buckingham. We called him Buck for short. He was short in stature too, but he was a darn good trumpet player. Buck had quite a bit of experience in playing. He had been playing his trumpet since he was about 10 years old. And he would make his little extra change in the summer by playing with a minstrel band. Get this now, a minstrel band. It so happened that that minstrel band had its winter quarters in Port Gibson, my little hometown, period. Well, the idea came to me that if I could get with that minstrel band that summer, I could make quite a bit of money, buy me some extra clothes for the coming school year, and above all, have the experience of playing with a minstrel band, and have the experience of some travel, especially through the South and the southeastern part of the United States. I asked Buckingham about my chances of being hired to play with the band during the coming summer. Well, he said, you know the home base of the band is Port Gibson. Do you know Mr. Walcott? He asked me. Mr. Walcott was the owner of the minstrel show. Yes, I knew Mr. Walcott. Knew him as the owner of the Rabbit Foot Minstrel Show. Part of Mr. Walcott's spiel whenever we got to a different town was this. Ladies and gentlemen, I am the owner of the mighty Rabbit Foot Minstrels, the greatest aggregation of comedians, contortionists, vocalists, and top flight musicians ever brought together in one magnificent, stupendous, soul-inspiring, group of veteran entertainers ever brought together in one stupendous organization. Existent in these United States of America, period. You should consider your fair city fortunate to be favored by our annual visit this year. I would urge you, one and all, to be present at 7:30 this p.m. The curtain rises. Present to you this stupendous group of individuals who will be glad to perform for you in our magnificent 10th theater that you will find located on the local showground, period. You have heard the magnificent rendition of John Philip Sousa's March Under the Double Eagle. As I came along, I noticed that you could not keep your feet still, that you pranced and smiled, even laughed, as the throbbing rendition of that most famous march ever composed was presented to you in a flawless rendition of our marching band, period. I would urge you to come one, come all. Meet us at 7:30 at our 10th theater. I thank you, ladies and gentlemen, one and all. That was more or less type of spiel, type of pep talk put on by the Honorable F.S. Walcott, Esquire, who was gaily decked out in a high hat, wing type collar with a wide bow tie, Prince Albert coat, striped pants, and spats, no matter how hot the weather, period. Accordingly, on one of my weekend trips to Port Gibson, I approached Mr. Walcott and asked him to take me on at the beginning of the next season's tour, period. Inasmuch as the tour began in mid-March, it would not be possible for Buckingham and me to join the band before school closed in mid-May. But Mr. Walcott had two trombone players. However, he said he would be glad to add a third, and that he would pay me $15 a week as third trombone player in his band. Now, Buckingham, a veteran in the show business, received $25 a week. But that was perfectly all right with me. $15 a week was much better than $6 a week working at David Box Department Store, period. To make the long story short, Buckingham received two train tickets for us along about the 1st of May. And the day after our final examination, we caught the train to meet the minstrel show in Greensboro, North Carolina, period. Now, I had been to Chicago. However, I considered the trip to Greensboro, North Carolina as the greatest event that had happened to my life to that day and time, period. The train trip carried us east through the cotton plantations of Mississippi and Alabama, on through the foothills of Georgia, round, around, and through the tree-covered foothills and mountains of South Carolina and North Carolina to Greensboro, period. Now, my real education was about to begin, period. We arrived in Greensboro, North Carolina about 11:30 p.m. First thing in order was to find a place to spend the night. Now, there was no such thing as a hotel for colored people. They called colored at that time. Transients and travelers had to be content with so-called rooming houses. Most of the rooming houses had thin mattresses, and where they had springs, the springs would stick in your side. In addition to that, bed bugs would chew on you from the time that the lights were put out until broad daylight, period. Nevertheless, we had to sleep disappeared. We were directed to a rooming house about 2 blocks from the train station. That is, across the railroad tracks, 2 blocks from the train station, period. We knocked. A young lady came to the door. She asked, what can we do for you? Buck spoke up. We would like to rent a room for the night. Okay, come on in. What are you doing in Greensboro? Well, we came here to join a minstrel show. Minstrel show? The lady asked with a sort of loud voice and look of disdain on her face. Mama, she called. Mother came out in a robe and a nightgown. What's the matter, daughter? These two fellas want a room, but they're going to join the minstrel show tomorrow. We don't want them in here, do we, Mama? Mother said, well, it's late. I don't guess you can find any place else to stay. We can give them the back room down there at the end of the hall. Mama, we going to let them stay here? Yeah, that's all right. They need some place to stay. We'll put them out. They're just going to be here tonight. They'll be getting out tomorrow morning. Well, coming from Port Gibson, Mississippi, where I had always been regarded as a harmless, nice little boy, falling into this situation where I was looked upon as something to be disdained and kicked out, I was beginning to be a little puzzled about how we would get along in this. Buckingham was very assuring. Oh, Queek, don't pay that into mind. After all, you know, we better than they are, but just don't let on that you know that, period. We arrived in Greensboro a day ahead of the minstrel show. However, we did know one person in Greensboro, a young man by the name of Joseph Smith, who was an accomplished musician. He could play all the wind instruments, all the string instruments, and he had been allowed to direct the band and orchestra at Oakland. He had taken the position of music director at Bennett College, B-E-N-N-E-T-T College, which at that time was a co-educational institution in Greensboro, North Carolina. We also knew one of the teachers at North Carolina A&T College at that time, Professor Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, who taught in the agricultural department of A&T College, period. The next morning, he asked the landlady, who was much more civil than her daughter, to let us leave our suitcases and band instruments in the boarding house until we could find another place to stay. In the meantime, we first went to Bennett College and got in contact with Joe. What about Bennett College? Bennett College was at that time a co-educational institution that was founded and maintained by the American Missionary Association, which was responsible for providing educational facilities all over the South for the training of Negro youth, period. Bennett College was not so large at that time. It was a co-educational institution. However, it was about to be converted into an all-girls college, period. Now, the orchestra was to play for the graduation exercise. However, they had no trombone in the orchestra, and the trumpet players were not so well trained, period. Joe was very glad to see us and asked us to end with his little orchestra and pay for the graduation exercises, period. When the graduates and other students began to assemble for the exercises, who should be on the first row? That same young lady who had been so nasty to us the night before. She ran over and was all full of apologies. She said, "Oh, if I'd only known that you were friends of Mr. Smith, I never would have acted so nasty last night," period. Accepted her apologies. And inasmuch as we were familiar with the music that Joe had arranged, I think we added somewhat to the occasion. Satisfaction of the entire audience, period. That same afternoon, there was a dance at A&T College, and we went over to the dance. Well, neither one of us was so bad looking, and we had no trouble finding dancing partners. However, another thing occurred at the dance, which led me to know that this menstrual life wasn't so hot. I was dancing with a cute young lady. We were really cutting the rug. So she asked me where I was from. I told her I was from Alcorn College. Oh yeah, that was very interesting. We talked a little longer. Say, "Well, what are you doing in Greensboro?" Say, "We're joining the menstrual show tomorrow." She said, "Oh, excuse me, I have a headache." He sat down and she spoke to the young lady sitting next to her. Well, in 10 shakes of a lamb's tail, I found that everybody had a headache. I pulled Buck aside. I said, "Look here, Buck, what's the matter with these girls? All of a sudden, nobody wants to dance with me." I said, "What'd you tell them?" I said, "I told them where I was from. Did she want to know what I was doing?" Yeah, I told her I was joining the menstrual show. "Say, you damn fool. Don't ever tell nobody you're a member of the menstrual show. Don't you know people don't like menstrual folks? They think all of us nasty. Housy, cutthroats, and thieves. Say, well, go on home. We're not going to get any more dances this afternoon." That was sort of bad. He said, "But don't worry. You know how you are. You know what you are. You don't have to take that word for it. I sort of down the cab. I'm ready to go back to Mississippi right away." As much as landlady's daughter knew that we were friends of Joe Smith, and as much as the word got around that we were top flight musicians, we had no trouble remaining in the boarding house for another night, period. Well, next morning, the minstrel show arrived. They had a car that was attached to one of the local trains. This car was switched to a siding, and we immediately went aboard, period. "Okay, come on, fellas. We got the parade is 12 o'clock. We got to get you ready to go on." Well, the lady who took care of the wardrobe measured my skinny frame and cut the costume down to fit me. It was a nice costume. It was light blue silk, modeled after a French army uniform, complete with a silk hat. I must confess that I thought I looked very well in that uniform. Of course, Buck's uniform was all ready for him, inasmuch as he had been there a year before, period. Now, here's where my real letdown came along. We had breakfast, and we were just about to line up for the parade. You know, trombones on the first row, you know. Passed out the music, some of the marches I was familiar with. Say, "Oh, well, this is going to be duck soup to me. I got it made." Just about that time, the band leader came out. this old pompous guy. His name was Mark Veal, M-A-R-K-V-E-A-L. Famous band, he was a famous band leader that day and time. And he came out with a stack of music. He said, "Well, boys, I just got this music out of the post office. Say, we're going to try these, we're going to play these marches this time. All of them are new, you don't know any of them, but I know you guys can catch on." I looked at the new music. I was puzzled, you know, confused, scared, angry, every damn thing. I never had seen that stuff before. So I turned around to him and said, "Mr. Veal, when are we going to practice?" He looked, everybody else looked around and he laughed. He said, "Son, what you say?" I said, "When are we going to practice?" I said, "Son, we don't practice. Say, we know this stuff. Say, you catch it on the fly. Come on, don't worry about it." But I was scared as hell because I didn't know what I had never seen the music before. And I was accustomed to practicing any new music until we got it perfected before we put it in our repertoire. As I've already stated, we lined up for the parade. I was shaking all over. Started down the street, and I realized that I really was not a trombonist. I was just a scared amateur about to drown in a sea of professionals, period. The drum major raised his baton, brought it down, and it started the parade. Drums started throbbing, but it wasn't throbbing as loud as my heart was. We started the first piece. I think I'd hit about every fourth or fifth note. Nobody seemed to pay any attention to it, however. After a while, I was going pretty good. I was catching on a little better. I could play three out of four notes. And I was so intent on to keep up with the remainder of the band that I did not see the drum major twirl his band to the right, indicating the route that the parade would take around the corner. I marched right straight ahead, was still playing like hell, and all of a sudden, it came to me that the music was getting faint. I looked around. I was marching in one direction, and the band was marching in the other. Lord, I knew I was done for then. I made such a poor showing that I was ready to go right back to Mississippi that day. Buck said, "Look here, fella, you can't go back now, you know. You got a ticket out here, but you don't have any ticket back to Mississippi." But brother, I started studying that stuff like hell. I studied all that afternoon. When the time came for pre-show concert in front of the tent, I had just a little bit more confidence, period. Well, I made it through the show in some way. I don't know how I made it through that show that night. Anyway, after the show was over, I found another great disappointment in store for me, period. Now this railroad car that they traveled on was half Pullman car and half baggage car. The tent and all that paraphernalia was stored in the baggage car, and there were eight upper berths and eight lower berths. All the space provided for 36 members of the minstrel crew, period. The crew slept two to a berth. Left four of us who had no berth on the car. As much as I was the last person to be hired on the show, I was paired with a contortionist. He was called Barrel, B-R-R-E-L, Barrel. You know, barrel like you have flour barrel, sugar barrel. Anyway, I was paired with Barrel, and we had to go out in the afternoon and find a larger place in whatever town we were in. After the show, we would go to this lodging and spend the night, but we'd have to be up in the morning in time to catch the train when that car was moved to another town, period. In other words, Harold had gone out and found a lodging place for us that night. It was one of those typical lodging houses with dirty sheets, illuminated by a kerosene lamp, and infested with bed bugs, period. That was the most miserable night I ever spent, period. Next morning, we had to catch the train, as I stated. The show car was so crowded that the four of us who could not find sleeping space on the car had to stand in the aisle from one town to the other. There wasn't even a place for us to sit down because everybody in the car would be sleeping late, period. They fed us breakfast about 9 o'clock. Then I set out with my friend and roommate, Barrow, to find another lodging place for that night, period. We passed down the street and saw a sign in the window, rooms for rent, period. Bell went up and knocked on the door, and a lady came to the door. Bell asked her, do you have a room for rent? Yes, we have one. How much is it? It's $1 a night. Do we see it? Yeah, come on in and take a look at it. It looks sort of decent. And the lady asked us, what are you doing in Salisbury, North Carolina? That is, we're here with the minstrel show. Minstrel show? That's the lady said. Minstrel show? Get out of my house. I don't allow no minstrel niggas in my house. Nasty, dirty, stinking, low-down, thieving niggas. Get out. She said, I thought you're gonna beat us up. But when we got out on the street, say, what's going on? What's the matter, Barrow? The old fella, don't pay him any mind. You know how it is. They don't think minstrel folks are any good at all. See? Well, we'll find some place to stay. Oh, my goodness, what the hell is this? Becoming more and more disenchanted with the idea of spending the summer being chased out of one chink-ridden boarding house after another, standing up between towns, trying to learn all this foreign music, being scorned by everybody in the street wherever we went as a bunch of no good minstrel niggas, period. The next night, the show was in a little town, Albermarle, Albemarle, North Carolina. Well, in that town, all the white folks lived on one side of the railroad, and the blacks lived on the other. And I walked all over the, quote, colored section, unquote, and finally came to a rundown two-story shotgun-type house where proprietor said we could sleep that night, period. I drank beer every Saturday for about 3 months and didn't put a pound on me at all. In the meantime, I continued to have to listen to Mr. Brooks talk on the weekends. He'd sip his bourbon and talk about his family and his exploits as a young man. One day he said, son, would you like to go fishing with me? I said, by all means, Mr. Brooks, I'd be glad to go with you. During the spring, when the weather became warm, our fishing trips began. First was after his day's work. He would get home about 5 o'clock, eat his dinner, and we would light out to a fishing hole. We would fish until darkness got so deep that we couldn't see the cork bobble up and down. I shall never forget the first trout I caught. There were several big logs that had fallen at the water's edge, and they extended out into the lake. I walked out on one of the logs, almost to the very end, which was about 40 feet from the shoreline. I dropped my hook in with a wiggling worm on it, and something grabbed it and started carrying it away. I yanked as hard as I could, and the fish was hooked. I was very excited. I pulled and pulled and got the fish into the log where I was standing. Mr. Brooks took a look. Hooray, boy, you caught a trout that time. What a fine one that is. Oh, I was tickled pink. But I made a big mistake right there at that instant. I took the fish off the hook, was holding the fish in my hand, trying to put it on a stringer with the other two or three white perch I'd caught. The fish gave one flip and was gone back into the water. And I was gone right back into the water with the fish. I couldn't swim. It just so happened that the water was just about 4 feet deep, and Mr. Brooks jumped in and pulled me out by my britches. Son, don't ever do that. You made a big mistake. You took the fish off the hook before you got your stringer ready, and look what happened. Well, he gave me a good lecture as to water safety, how to handle my fish, and how to keep cool, not become excited, period. Along about the middle of August that year, I began to tire of the fishing trips. And during the day when Mr. Brooks was at work, I would wander over town. I would wander to the garage and watch Mr. Fritz Moore work on automobiles. I'd go up by the pressing shop, watch Gus Lefure, L-E-F-U-R-E, clean and press clothes. All the time I was becoming more and more bored. Then there was this little gang of what I might call juvenile delinquents that I ran around with. There were about 7 or 8 of us who spent the days on end picking up scrap iron to sell, running errands for anybody who wanted to ask us to do such. However, when picking became very slim so far as the scrap iron and errands were concerned, some of the members of the little group decided they would sort of steal little things, that any little thing that could be sold on the corner. There was even talk of breaking in houses when it was known that the occupants of the house were not at home. That's right where I quit the gang. I became a loner, and the gang went on its merry way. I might add here that within the next 2 years, 3 members of the gang had been sent to reform school for stealing, period. After I quit running with my little gang, I began to amuse myself by walking around over town, looking in on anything that became interesting to me. First of all, I would go to the local garage and watch Mr. Fritz Moore, F-R-I-T-Z, Moore, work on automobiles. Tiring of that, I would stop by the pressing shop and watch Gus Lefure, G-U-S, L-E-F-U-R-E, clean and press clothes. Then there was my cousin Fred King, shoemaker. That was a nice place to go and sit and hear the long tales being told. Cousin Fred came from the country. He went down to Alcorn College to learn shoemaking. Came back to Port Gibson and set up his shoe shop. He was doing very, very well. He even worked up to a huge Singer sewing machine that sewed soles on shoes. No motor. It was run by heavy, foot power. But it was a great contraption to me, period. And I really enjoyed watching that strong needle carry that heavy thread in and out of the shoe sole, attaching it firmly to the sides of the shoes, period. I liked it so well that I decided one day I would probably become a shoemaker, period. Well, long about that time, the larger, most important drugstore in town was totally destroyed by fire, period. That really gave me something to watch. I watched the workmen burned out fixtures. I watched the carpenters come in, do their job. Painters, the plasterers came in and did their work. The tile men came in and laid the tile floor. Across the front of the floor was the name J.G. Joseph, spelled out in the tile, period. When they started to put in the new fixtures, I was always around to see what was going on, period. When they unpacked the showcases, it was noticed that the interior of the showcases needed cleaning. Now, I was the smartest thing around there, and Mr. J.G. Joseph, the owner, took one look at me and said, "Kid, get in there and clean those showcases. I'll give you some change." "Yes, sir, that's just what I wanted to do." I cleaned the showcases real well. Cleaned them to the satisfaction of Mr. Joseph. And he paid me 35 cents for that job. I worked about a half a day for only so. But he decided that there were other little things need to be done. So he started calling on me, "Quick, do this, quick, do that." Now, here I found a place where I was wanted, where I was needed. I was very happy with that. When the time to reopen the drugstore drew near, Mr. Joseph looked around and said, "Well, we're gonna need a delivery boy. How would you like that job, quick?" "Yes, sir, that's the very thing I would like to do. I love that." "Okay, we'll pay you $4 a week." "That's satisfactory?" "Yes, sir, that's satisfactory." I knew that I would be in the drugstore where I could eat all the ice cream I wanted, drink all the Coca-Colas I wanted, and not have to work too hard even at that, period. Time came for reopening the drugstore, and Mr. Joseph picked out his places he would need to operate his drugstore. First, there was Mr. Joseph himself, who was the owner and the registered pharmacist. There was a young white man by the name of Neil Hackett. We called him Mr. Happy Hackett. Then there was Abram Graves, whom we call Jabo, J-A-B-O. He was black, period. He acted as the chief janitor, stock man, and the fellow who made that good store-bought ice cream, period. My job, delivery boy, period. Between deliveries, I enjoyed sitting back in the pharmacy watching Mr. Jake Joseph fill the prescriptions. Then he gave me the job of washing and sterilizing bottles so that it could be reused to contain the prescription that he filled, period. Later, he gave me the job of filling those 1 and 2 ounce flat-sided bottles with turpentine, castor oil, sweet spirits of nitre, N-I-T-R-E. Which was a strong smelling substance that the country folk used for treatment of bellyache, and fever, period. Then Jabbo started calling on me to help him freeze the ice cream. Jabbo was a past master at combining the ingredients for the ice cream. That is, mixing the milk, the cream, the flavoring, with some gelatin to give the ice cream smoothness, period. I liked that part of my wake because I knew that after the ice cream was all frozen and transferred to the big 10-gallon cans up at the soda fountain, there would always be enough for me to fill up on before I began the task of cleaning up the ice cream freezer and flushing out the freezing room with first hot and then cold water, period. I kept that job at the drugstore for 3 years. However, there was a department store further down the block where I heard they needed a delivery boy. Now Mr. Joseph was paying me $4 a week, but Mr. Kraus, K-R-A-U-S-S, at D Box, D, capital D, the B-O-C-K, department store, offered to pay me $6 a week as a delivery boy. That was a whole dollar a day. I couldn't turn the offer down, period. While sitting around Bo Watson's barbershop, that's capital B, little O, W-A-T-S-O-N, yes, Bo Watson's barbershop, I mentioned the fact that I was going to change jobs. One of my traveling buddies by the name of John Odom, O-D-O-M, asked me to recommend him for a job at the drugstore. Well, I told him I would recommend him under one condition. That was, if I ever wanted to get my job back, I could come and take it from him. He agreed to that. I told Mr. Joseph I had a good man for him, and introduced John. And would you believe it, comma, John Odom worked at that drugstore from 1915 to 1970, at which time he retired, period. On my trip back home to Port Gibson, Mississippi, I would always drop into the drugstore and ask for John Odom. It must be remembered just here that the drugstore changed ownership about 6 times. And along about the 5th time when I came in and asked for John Odom, the owners did not know who I was. And when I would first ask for John and tell the owners that I was coming back to check on my job, which would puzzle the owners very much. And John would come out to greet me. We would explain to the new owners just why I came in and made that particular statement. It was always amusing to everybody concerned, period. Now back to my story. I started work at the D-Box department store. That job was very interesting too. Now, right here, a word about the personnel. The owner of the store was Mr. David Bock, B-O-C-K, a man who immigrated from Poland and traveled throughout that portion of the South as a peddler with a pack on his back. He sold cloth, lace, and everything that a woman would need to make clothes for her family, period. He kept his money together to such an extent that he was able to open a small store in Port Gibson. He instinctively knew what poor people wanted, what poor people needed, and he furnished the merchandise at an attractive price to them, and his business prospered to the extent that his store was ultimately enlarged and took on the impressive name of D. David Bach Department Store, period. Mr. David Bach went on to establish a wholesale business in Vicksburg, Mississippi, which was about 35 miles north of Port Gibson, period. After opening his store in Port Gibson, he sent back to Poland and got his younger brother, Felix. Now, Felix Bach became the bookkeeper and the cashier at the store, period. Next was Mr. Sid Krauss, K-R-A-U-S-S, a member of a family of merchants who had a store in Fayette, F-A-Y-A-T-T, Mississippi, period. As I understand it, Mr. Krauss bought into the business of D. Bach Department Store with monies from his relatives in Fayette, period. There was Mr. Johnny Watkins, the son of a butcher in Port Gibson, who was the chief salesman at the department store. There was a younger fellow whose name was Hicks, H-I-X, Anderson, who himself was the son of an immigrant from Sweden. His immigrant father was a bookkeeper for another merchant in the town who was known as H, capital letter H, period, Frischman, F-R-I-S-H-M-A-N. His slogan was H. Frischman, the poor man's friend, period. Now back to the store. I brought up the rear as the porter, delivery boy, etc., 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 period. I liked the job at the store. It made me feel important. It made me feel good to know that I had certain duties to perform and that I carried out my duties to the satisfaction of the owners, period. Now, I was in that job about 3 years. However, I became more and more dissatisfied with my lot, and I questioned within myself the wisdom of having quit school, period. While talking to the other people who worked in the store one day, Mr. Watkins reminded me that there had been another porter who worked at the store for 16 years before quitting to go north, period. Now, I was getting $6 a week. I asked Mr. Watkins, how much were they paying this fellow George, who preceded me? He said, well, he'd worked there all those years, and they were paying him $15 a week. Sounds sort of bad to me. Now, here's a man who'd worked here, started out, worked here 15 or 16 years, started with a wages of a salary of $6 a week, and after all those years, his salary was only $15 a week. I began to think about that. I couldn't see myself working in a store for 15 years and only being paid it'll have $15 to $20 a week at the end of that time. Period. Now, I became more and more dissatisfied and began to question in my mind the wisdom of having quit school when I did, period. During the Christmas holidays, and during the times when we had sales at the school, other young fellows were about my age were employed to help out. However, all of them were in school. They were talking better than I was talking. They could read faster. And I was just beginning to envy those fellows, period. In the meantime, Mr. Brooks had decided to bring his wife from Kentucky and buy a home in Port Gibson. Mom Brooks, as I called her, was a very present little lady. We took to each other right away, period. Mom Brooks tried to get me fat too. She fed the heck out of me. I would eat at home and then go to Mom Brooks' house and eat some more. To no avail, I never gained a pound, period. I saw Mr. Brooks one day and he said, "Well, Milton, my granddaughter Maddie is coming to spend the summer with us. Boy, I know you're going to like Maddie, period." Well, one day I was arranging a display in one of the free show windows in front of the store. And I looked up to see Mr. Brooks looking in the show window along with the cutest little brown-skinned girl I'd ever seen in my life. I almost fell out of that show window getting out to speak to them, period. Maddie was a little short, but she had two long black plaits of hair that hung almost to her, just about to her waist, period. She had a soothing voice, and she didn't have that Mississippi drawl that I was accustomed to, period. Mr. Brooks said, "Well, what do you think about my granddaughter?" I couldn't do anything but stand there and stammer. I immediately said I'd be down for supper today, period. I wanted to get acquainted with Maddie right away, and that I did, period. Maddie was down to visit her parents along with her mother, period. Maddie's father was the general secretary of the CME Church. As such, he traveled all over the country, period. Maddie was a junior in high school. Now here I was, just finished the fifth grade. That didn't sit well with me either. Come Sunday morning, I went to church. Maddie was there. She played a solo on her violin. I'd gone nuts by that time, about this pretty little girl. In no time flat, we were going steady with the smiling approval of Maddie's mother, period. Maddie's father was the general secretary of the CME Church, and in that position, he traveled all over the United States, period. He came to Port Gibson to visit his family. I met this tall, dignified gentleman who apparently approved of me also. I was on cloud nine by that time. After church and after eating dinner, I would turn up around the Brooks home and we would go off on our Sunday afternoon walk. At that day and time, we had no disco, we had no TV, we had no radio. But boy, comma, was it fun. Take those long walks around town and return home just about dusk. And if nobody was looking in either direction, I would steal a kiss just before we got to Mr. Brooks' house, period. It just so happened that there was a very successful black farmer in the community who had a son just about my age, but who, unlike me, had continued to go to school. He met Maddie too, and he took a shine to her, just as I had. He began to pay a little bit too much attention to Maddie for my comfort. To make bad matters worse and worse, his father had a big, long Studebaker car. One Sunday I went around to Maddie to take our regular Sunday afternoon walk, and she had just left with this young fella in that big, long Studebaker. Boy, comma, was I miserable! Exclamation mark, period. That guy started making inroads on my territory. I began to resent his intrusion. And Maddie seemed to enjoy every bit of this turn of events, period. After he started riding her around in a Studebaker, I could be found on Sunday afternoon sitting on the corner, turning green whenever they passed by, period. Now, all of my buddies sensed the situation. They gave me consolation, and they tried to figure out a way to get back at Tommy Johnson. Without having to be put in jail, period. It was true I would go around to the Brooks household at intervals, but it seemed as though Tommy Johnson was making a headway. I was losing ground every day, period. As the summer drew to a close, time came for Maddie to go back to Kentucky and back to school, period. However, Maddie let it be known to everybody, including me, that Tommy Johnson and Studebaker were just passing fantasies, period. And in the end, I was the guy who walked with her to the railroad station where she was to board the train to go back to Kentucky, period. I have already mentioned the fact that I had become disenchanted with my state for the summer that I met Maddie, period. To backtrack just a little, I went to the graduating exercise, at which time the kids that I had been going to school with were finishing school. And all of a sudden I realized that I was just about to miss the boat, although the school went on through the ninth grade. They were graduating, and some of them were going off to college. And there I was, left in Port Gibson, finished the fifth grade, had met Maddie. Lord knows I wanted to see more of that beautiful young lady at a later date. But I could see myself getting nowhere with her, and nowhere in the world. I could see myself being pushed aside by anybody like Tommy Johnson, who had continued to go to school. I saw myself having to give up my dream of becoming a doctor. I saw myself having to be satisfied with a job that paid as much as $15 a week for the rest of my life, period. After the graduating exercise, I went home and I started talking to my parents. Mama, just why was it that you didn't make me go to school like you made Thelma go to school. Why didn't you later switch on me and make me go? They tried to evade the question, but I insisted upon knowing why. Well, comma, Mama reminded me of the time that I was, quote, sick, unquote, and they called in the doctor to see me. She reminded me that the doctor had called him aside and spoke to them a while. She further reminded me that they came back in, both she and my father, and told me that I didn't have to go to school unless I wanted to go to school. She said the reason they had made that decision was that the doctor had examined me and called him aside to tell him that in all probability, I would not live to get grown. And the best thing that they could do with me was to let me have all the fun I wanted. And if I didn't want to go to school, not to make me go to school. Well, you could have knocked me over with a chicken feather, because first of all, I wasn't sick at all. And secondly, I did not anticipate dying before I had a chance to make my way in this world, period. Now, there was one smart kid in the class. His name was Henry Johnson, period. That fall, he went to Alcorn A&M College, spelled that A-L-C-O-R-N, Alcorn A&M College, which was the land grant college maintained by the state of Mississippi for Negro youth, period. Although he had only finished the ninth grade, he had taken the entrance examination at Alcorn, and his intelligence was such that he was admitted to the freshman college class, period. When Henry came back to Port Gibson at the end of his first year at Alcorn, I began to talk to him. I explained my problem to him and told him I wanted to go back to school, but I did not intend to go back to school in the sixth grade with all those little snotty-nosed kids, period. Now, it just happened, just so happened that I had been down at Alcorn several times, and I had talked to a lot of the students down there, period. Talked to some of the grown men and women. When I asked them what class they were in, a lot of them told me that they were in the sixth grade now. Now, look here. Wait a minute here. Wait. Here's a grown man down at Alcorn in the sixth grade. I asked one of the fellas why. Why was he in the sixth grade and not in college? He said, well, he had finished the fourth grade and dropped out of school to farm, to work on the farm. After he got grown, he decided he wanted to go back to school and become a teacher, period. He came to Alcorn and applied for admission, and he was given an entrance examination. It was found that he was intelligent and able to learn, but that he would have to start in the sixth grade, which was the lowest grade taught at Alcorn, and stay in the sixth grade until he could go further. He pointed out a senior at Alcorn at that time, and he told me that the senior had been at Alcorn for 11 years. During that time, he had advanced from the sixth grade to his final year as a senior. In other words, if a person would come to Alcorn, even illiterate, they would put him in the sixth grade and keep him there until he could go forward into the seventh and eighth and on, period. Well, when I talked to Henry, He asked me a lot of questions about what I'd been reading. And I had been reading everything from the Saturday Evening Post through Shakespeare and Greek mythology, period. With that background, he thought that if I could be admitted to the eighth grade, I could go on from there, period. So we planned that thing so that he would tutor me so that I could take the ninth grade examination. Naturally, we both knew that I would flunk the ninth grade, but maybe the admitting teacher would put me back in the eighth grade so I could go on from there. Now, comma, Henry worked with his father, hauling freight from the depot to the different stores, just as my daddy was doing. Well, Mama would make 5 gallons of ice cream. Pop would sell the ice cream on Saturday to the people from the country. There would always be some left. So I made a bargain with Henry that I'd give him all the ice cream he could eat on Saturday and Sunday if he would tutor me. That was fine. So here, there we go now. Well, as far as I'd gotten was arithmetic. I had to review arithmetic, get ready for eighth grade arithmetic, which would go into algebra. All foreign to me, but I just caught on anyway. I remember when we were talking about getting the circumference of a circle. He said something about pi equal this and that and the other. I said, where the hell do they call it pi? He said, well, that's what they call it. That's a Greek word. Oh, yeah. Well, we went on. He taught me all the parts of speech, definition for the parts of speech, and an example of how it's used in a sentence. Now, when he started with me, I didn't know a preposition from a proposition. But during that summer, I worked very hard. In mid-July of that year, I was at work at the department store, and I found Mr. Krauss to be a very kindly man. And several times we talked, and he said, boy, you should go back in school. Well, you got a lot in you that could come out if you just got some education. He was delighted when I told him I had decided to go to school in the fall. In fact, everybody in the store was delighted. Next thing I did was scrawl a letter to Maddie, tell Maddie that I was going back to school. I got a 3-page letter back from Maddie. She was delighted. Yeah, I'm ready to go now. Mr. Krauss gave me one of those little tin trunks. They had a wooden frame, was covered with tin. A tray in the top. I got my little clothes together. Me and my brother, we had a lot of socks around there. We couldn't decide whose socks belonged to whom. So we decided that I would take all the white socks and he'd take all the colored socks. Mr. Krauss gave me some clothes. He had a son named Ferdie, F-E-R-D-I-E. Little older than I was. His clothes fit me all right, except that his collars were too big for me. I only wore, my neck size was 13, period. I wrote for application for admission to Alcorn, which came back in due time. With Henry's help, I filled them out. And the time came for me to go to Alcorn College. I felt very big that day. I got down to Alcorn and went to the teacher who took care of admissions. And I told him I came to be admitted to the ninth grade. He said, did you bring your record from school? I told him that the big lie right there. I told him that the principal was out of town and that he didn't get back in time to be together, but I'd be glad to take the examination. That's the biggest lie. The first big lie I ever told. But anyway, he put the examination up on the board. fast mark was 17. I think I made about 52, which I thought was great. Naturally, he said, well, my young man, I'm sorry, but I can't let you go in the ninth grade because you failed the examination, which was very fair. I said, yeah. Now, me and Henry got together on this thing. I looked quick. Now, he's going to flunk you out. You can't go in the ninth grade. Say, but now you just raise a little racket there, insisting going in the ninth grade. I'll be outside. When I hear you raise your voice, I'm going to come in, and we'll go out and talk this thing over, and you go back and take the eighth. Sure enough, that's what happened. I say, but I know, right loud, that I'm supposed to be in the ninth grade. In steps Henry Johnson. Professor, wait a minute. Let me talk to this fellow here. I think I can get him to understand what's going on. So we went out behind the building and danced the jig. Everything was turning out fine. Came back with a downcast look on my face. Said, okay, I'll take the eighth grade, but I should be in the ninth. The teacher started to him and said, that's all right. Don't say anything. Don't worry, Professor. We'll take care of him. I'll take care of him, and he'll be all right. That was all right. I was admitted to the eighth grade. The next day when the class was organized, I had such a big mouth, they made me the president. Now here I was, president of the eighth grade class, and I was so dumb I didn't know a noun from a hound, period. Now, I don't know whether I mentioned it before, however, I feel that I should tell you something about my trombone playing, period. The colored, they call them then, colored people in Port Gibson, Mississippi were, I'd say, of the average intelligence, or I might say a little above average in intelligence, masses of it. Somehow they learned to appreciate good music, and they had a brass band. Composed of black musicians, period. The leader of the band, or the band director, was named George Comfort, C-O-M-F-O-R-T. My daddy played in the band, and of course all the band members were a close-knit group of men. They bragged about one day, one of the members of the band left his trombone at our home. I asked him, could I play the trombone? He said, go on, try it, see what you can do with it. Well, immediately I started picking out some tunes on the trombone. My sister Ruth would come in, she could play the piano very well. And we made a duo. And the next thing you know, I was picking out entire pieces. Popular pieces at that day and time, period. In addition to the brass band, there were a group of men who played string instruments, and they had what they called a string band. String band was composed of two violins, three guitars, two mandolins, a bass viol. They played for dances, picnics, any type of gathering. I asked him to let me sit in with them and play my trombone. I was playing by ear, but I picked that thing up. It was going along pretty good. And subsequently, they began to include me in the group, and I would make anywhere from $2, $3 to $5 playing for a dance or for any group that would employ the little string band, period. It just so happened that Mr. Comfort had been chosen by the president of Alcorn to take over the direction of the Alcorn College Band. In addition to that job, he was what we would call now supervisor of the food services, period. Now, at that day and time, there were about 500 students at Alcorn College. And of course, at mealtime, anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes was wasted in getting the students in and out of the dining hall for their meals, period. Mr. Comfort, my father made me call him Uncle George. Well, Uncle George found a way to get these students in and out of the dining hall in a hurry. He developed a small orchestra, the function of which was to start playing a stirring march as the bell for the particular meal would start to ring. The students, both men and women, would march in, march to the tables to which they had been assigned, be waiting for the blessing to be sung in just about 3 minutes, period. Now, Uncle George Comfort had charge of the little orchestra that played in the dining hall as well as the band. It just so happened that the trombone player in the group had graduated that spring. When I came down there with my trombone, Uncle George gave me the job of playing trombone with the group, much to the dismay of one of the student trombone players who had counted on that job before I got there. We received our board as payment for our services playing during the meal time, period. Thus, I was assured of my board from the very first day I got to Alcorn, period. Tuition was very cheap. I think it was about $25 a year, inasmuch as Alcorn was a state-supported school, period. Well, my first day or so at Alcorn was very interesting to me. First of all, I was put in a room with Henry Johnson, two other fellows. There were four of us to each room. Now, these weren't just small rooms. Put a hyphen here. I guess I'd better tell you about Alcorn College now, at this point, period. Many years before the Civil War, the big plantation owners in the area had difficulty in obtaining proper teachers for the education of their sons and daughters, period. A group of them got together and decided to build an academy, it was at that time, in a central location, employed teachers so that their children could have proper education. They chose a site about 8 miles from the Mississippi River, 8 miles from a little town, Rodney, R-O-D-N-E-Y, Mississippi. The site was just about equidistant between Vicksburg and Natchez. After railroads had been developed to serve that area, the site was located about 8 miles from the nearest railroad. Thus, transportation to and from the school by a riverboat and by a railroad, period. The academy was called Oakland, O-A-K-L-A-N-D, College, period. And here and there, big plantation owners had built elaborate palatial homes that are still standing today and serve as show places to people who would like to relive the splendors of the antebellum area. One such mansion was built near Alcorn College. However, the mansion was destroyed by a fire in the early 1900s. Some of the tall columns are left standing today. And in nearby Natchez, several of the homes are maintained in their original splendor. And every spring, tours are made to Natchez, Vicksburg, and that area down in there, so that present-day American can relive, in part, the splendors of the antebellum area, period. Following the Civil War, Oakland College was abandoned, period. Of course, University of Mississippi had long been established. However, there was a crying need for place to educate the recently freed slaves, period. A drive was put on by the Mississippi legislators, who at that time were mostly black, to obtain a college site. During the term of Governor James L. Alcorn, A-L-C-O-R-N, that site of Oakland College was taken over, be converted into a center of higher learning for blacks, period. The first president of Alcorn College, as such, was former Senator Hiram R. Revels, R-E-V-E-L-S. He had been a United States Senator from Mississippi, and after he lost re-election to the United States Senate, he was appointed by Governor Alcorn as the first president of Alcorn College, period. At that time, the college consisted of a chapel, which was located at the center of a semicircle. There were three dormitories on the right of the chapel and three dormitories on the left, period. Each of the dormitories to the right of the chapel was a two-story building with four large rooms on each floor, period. Four students were assigned to each of the rooms, period. To the left of the chapel, there was first the residence of the president of the college, and next, a dormitory for girls. Further on, two dormitories that house boys, period. The building farthest to the left was called Bell's Letters, B-E-L-L-E-S-L-E-T-T-R-E-S. Most of the buildings of old Alcorn College have been removed so that more modern student facilities could be built. However, the chapel remains standing, as well as Bell's Letters dormitory at the far left of the semicircle, period. Later, a dining hall was built facing the chapel and some distance from it, with walks extending from each of the dormitories to the dining hall, period. So much for the original building arrangement. A huge moss-covered oak trees situated at intervals all over the campus, period. Oh, before we leave a description of the buildings, I want to describe the heating arrangement. Each room was heated by a large fireplace, period. And some of the students who for their bed and board, remained at the school during the summer, and cut enough firewood logs to heat the building for the entire winter, period. Now, comma, there were some modern steam heated buildings on the campus when I went down there to school. However, I was advised by Henry and other students who had been there over a period of years not to seek lodging in the modern building with the steam heat, but to try to arrange to stay in one of the older buildings where they had fireplaces, period. Why? Comma. We could supplement our diet of grits and gravy, occasionally corned beef hash for breakfast, always navy beans for dinner, such delicacies as rabbits, squirrel, fish, and a misplaced chicken from time to time that we could cook in our dormitories after all the lights were out and all the shades were drawn. However, cooking was strictly forbidden in the dormitory rooms, but the monitors of the respective buildings would never turn anybody in for cooking as long as they could get a piece of the rabbit, a squirrel, a chicken, etc., whatever was being cooked, period. I was assigned to a room with Henry Johnson, his brother, and one other student. When I got to the room, I found a bed, a dresser, and a fireplace. As for mattresses, we found an empty new empty mattress cover lying on each bed, period. I asked, where's the mattress? Henry said, come on, you'll see. We took the mattress cover to the barn and filled it with some fresh new mown hay. The mattress was well stuffed with hay. I said, why put so much hay in here? He said, well, after about a month, it'll be bedded down. Be a nice, comfortable place to sleep. Oh boy, that first night was all I could do to keep from rolling out of the bed because of that overstuffed mattress, period. The next morning I was awakened by the chapel bell ringing at 6 o'clock.